this is Mary Jo Schottelkotty for the Holistic Half Hour on WRRS, focusing on the health of your body, mind, and spirit. Last week, we started a book called Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End, written by Dr. Atul Gawande. And we had read the introduction and just started chapter one, The Independent Self. And he is sharing with us the experience of meeting his wife's grandmother, who had recently become widowed and was living independently, and he had no exposure to serious illness or difficulty with old age prior to this. So getting back to where we left off, as time went on, it became hard not to wonder how much longer she'd be able to manage. She was a petite woman, 5 feet tall at most, and although she bristled when anyone suggested it, she lost some height and strength with each passing year. When I married her granddaughter, Alice beamed and held me close and told me how happy the wedding made her, but she'd become too arthritic to share a dance with me. And still, she remained in her home, managing on her own. When my father met her, he was surprised to learn she lived by herself. He was a urologist, which meant he saw many elderly patients, and it always bothered him to find them living alone. The way he saw it, if they didn't already have serious needs, they were bound to develop them, and coming from India, he felt it was the family's responsibility to take the aged in, give them company, and look after them. Since arriving in New York City in 1963 for his residency training, my father had embraced virtually every aspect of American culture. He gave up vegetarianism and discovered dating. He got a girlfriend, a pediatrics resident from a part of India where they didn't speak his language. When he married her, instead of letting my grandfather arrange his marriage, the family was scandalized. He became a tennis enthusiast, president of the local Rotary Club, and teller of bawdy jokes. One of his proudest days was July 4th, 1976, the country's bicentennial, when he was made an American citizen in front of hundreds of cheering people in the grandstand at the Athens County Fair between the hog auction and the demolition derby. But one thing he could never get used to was how we treat our old and frail, leaving them to a life alone or isolating them in a series of anonymous facilities, their last conscious moments spent with nurses and doctors who barely knew their names. Nothing could have been more different from the world he had grown up in. My father's father had the kind of traditional old age that, from a Western perspective, seems idyllic. Sitaram Gawande was a farmer in a village called Uti, some 300 miles inland from Mumbai, where our ancestors had cultivated land for centuries. I remember visiting him with my parents and sister around the same time I met Alice, when he was more than 100 years old. He was by far the oldest person I'd ever known. He walked with a cane, stooped like a bent stalk of wheat. He was so hard of hearing that people had to shout in his ear through a rubber tube. He was weak and sometimes needed help getting up from sitting. But he was a dignified man, with a tightly wrapped white turban, a pressed brown argyle cardigan, and a pair of old-fashioned, thick-lensed, Malcolm X-style spectacles. He was surrounded and supported by family at all times, and he was revered, not in spite of his age, but because of it. He was consulted on all important matters, marriages, land disputes, business decisions, and occupied a place of high honor in the family. When we ate, we served him first. When young people came into his house, they bowed and touched his feet in supplication. In America, he would almost certainly have been placed in a nursing home. Health professionals have a formal classification system for the level of function a person has. If you cannot, without assistance, use the toilet, eat, dress, bathe, groom, get out of bed, get out of a chair, and walk, the 8 activities of daily living, then you lack the capacity for basic physical independence. If you cannot shop for yourself, prepare your own food, maintain your housekeeping, do your laundry, manage your medications, make phone calls, travel on your own, and handle your finances, the 8 independent activities of daily living, then you lack the capacity to live safely on your own. My grandfather could perform only some of the basic measures of independence and few of the more complex ones. But in India, this was not of any dire consequence. His situation prompted no family crisis meeting, no anguished debates over what to do with him. It was clear that the family would ensure my grandfather could continue to live as he desired. One of my uncles and his family lived with him, and with a small herd of children, grandchildren, nieces, and nephews nearby, he never lacked for help. The arrangement allowed him to maintain a way of life that few elderly people in modern societies can count on. The family made it possible, for instance, for him to continue to own and manage his farm, which he had built up from nothing, indeed, from worse than nothing. His father had lost all but 2 mortgaged acres and 2 emaciated bulls to a moneylender when the harvest failed 1 year. He then died, leaving Sitaram, his eldest son, with the debts. Just 18 years old and newly married, Sitaram was forced to enter into indentured labor on the family's 2 remaining acres. At one point, the only food he and his bride could afford was bread and salt. They were starving to death, but he prayed and stayed at the plow, and his prayers, were answered. The harvest was spectacular. He was able to not only put food on the table, but also pay off his debts. In subsequent years, he expanded his 2 acres to more than 200. He became one of the richest landowners in the village and a money lender himself. He had 3 wives, all of whom he outlived, and 13 children. He emphasized education, hard work, frugality, earning your own way, staying true to your word, and holding others strictly accountable for doing the same. Throughout his life, he awoke before sunrise and did not go to bed until he'd done a nighttime inspection of every acre of his fields by horse. Even when he was 100, he would insist on doing this. My uncles were worried he'd fall. He was weak and unsteady, but they knew it was important to him. So they got him to a smaller horse and made sure that someone always accompanied him. He made the rounds of his fields right up to the year he died. Had he lived in the West, this would have seemed absurd. "It isn't safe," his doctor would say. If he persisted, then fell and went to an emergency room with a broken hip, the hospital would not let him return home. They'd insist that he go to a nursing home. But in my grandfather's pre-modern world, how he wanted to live was his choice, and the family's role was to make it possible. My grandfather finally died at the age of almost 110. It happened after he hit his head falling off a bus. He was going to the courthouse in a nearby town on business, which itself seemed crazy, but it was a priority to him. The bus began to move while he was getting off, and although he was accompanied by family, he fell. Most probably, he developed a subdermal hematoma, bleeding inside his skull. My uncle got him home, and over the next couple of days he faded away. He got to live the way he wished, and with his family around him right to the end. For most of human history, for those few people who actually survived to old age, Sitaram Gawande's experience was the norm. Elders were cared for in multi-generational systems, often with 3 generations living under one roof. Even when the nuclear family replaced the extended family as it did in Northern Europe several centuries ago. The elderly were not left to cope with the infirmities of age on their own. Children typically left home as soon as they were old enough to start families of their own. But one child usually remained, often the youngest daughter, if the parents survived into census. This was the lot of the poet Emily Dickinson in Amherst, Massachusetts, in the mid-19th century. Her elder brother left home, married, and started a family, but she and her younger sister stayed with their parents until they died. As it happened, Emily's father lived to the age of 71, by which time she was in her 40s, and her mother lived even longer. She and her sister ended up spending their entire lives in the parental home. As different as Emily Dickinson's parents' life in America seems from that of Sitaram Gawande's in India, both relied on systems that shared the advantage of easily resolving the question of care for the elderly. There was no need to save up for a spot in a nursing home or arrange for Meals on Wheels. It was understood that parents would just keep living in their house, or their home, assisted by one or more of the children they'd raised. In contemporary societies, by contrast, old age and infirmity have gone from being a shared, multi-generational responsibility to a more or less private state, something experienced largely alone, or with the aid of doctors and institutions. How did this happen? How did we go from Sitaram Gawande's life to Alice Hobson's? One answer is that old age itself has changed. In the past, surviving into old age was uncommon, and those who did survive served a special purpose as guardians of tradition, knowledge, and history. They tended to maintain their status and authority as heads of the household until death. In many societies, elders not only commanded respect and obedience, but also led sacred rites and wielded political power. So much respect accrued to the elderly that people used to pretend to be older than they were, not younger, when giving their age. People have always lied about how old they are. Demographers call the phenomenon age heaping and have devised complex quantitative contortions to correct for all the lying and consensus. They have also noticed that during the 18th century, in the United States and Europe, the direction of our lies changed. Whereas today people often understate their age to census takers, studies of past consensus have revealed that they used to overstate it. The dignity of old age was something to which everyone aspired. But age no longer has the value of rarity. In America, in 1790, people aged 65 or older constituted less than 2% of the population. Today, they are 14%. In Germany, Italy, and Japan, they exceed 20%. China is now the first country on earth with more than 100 million elderly people. As for the exclusive hold that elders once had on knowledge and wisdom, that too has eroded thanks to technologies of communication, starting with writing itself and extending to the internet and beyond. New technology also creates new occupations and requires new expertise, which further undermines the value of long experience and seasoned judgment. At one time, we might have turned to an old-timer to explain the world. Now we consult Google, and if we have any trouble with the computer, we ask a teenager. Perhaps most important of all, increased longevity has brought about a shift in the relationship between the young and the old. Traditionally, surviving parents provided a source of much-needed stability, advice, and economic protection for young families seeking pathways to security. And because landowners also tended to hold on to their property until death, the child who sacrificed everything to care for the parents could expect to inherit the whole homestead, or at least a larger portion than a child who moved away. But once parents were living markedly longer lives, tension emerged. For young people, the traditional family system became less a source of security than a struggle for control, over property, finances, and even the most basic decisions about how they could live. And indeed, my grandfather Sitaram's traditional household, generational tension was never far away. You can imagine how my uncles felt as their father turned 100, and they entered old age themselves, still waiting to inherit land and gain economic independence. I learned of bitter battles in villages, families between elders and adult children over land and money. In the final year of my grandfather's life, an angry dispute erupted between him and my uncle with whom he lived. The original cause was unclear. Perhaps my uncle had made a business decision without my grandfather. Maybe my grandfather wanted to go out and no one in the family would go with him. Maybe he liked to sleep with the window open and they liked to sleep with the window closed. Whatever the reason, the argument culminated, depending on who told the story, in Sitaram's either storming out of the house in the dead of night or being locked out. He somehow made it miles away to another relative's house and refused to return for 2 months. Global economic development has changed opportunities for the young dramatically. Prosperity of whole countries depends on their willingness to escape the shackles of family expectation and follow their own path, to seek out jobs wherever they might be, do whatever work they want, marry whom they desire. So it was with my father's path from UT to Athens, Ohio. He left the village first for university in Nagpur, and then for professional opportunities in the United States. As he became successful, he sent ever larger amounts of money home, helping to build new houses for his father and siblings, bring clean water and telephones to the village, and install irrigation systems that ensured harvests when the rainy seasons were bad. He even built a rural college nearby that he named for his mother. But there was no denying that he had left, and he wasn't going back. Disturbed though my father was by the way America treated its elderly, the more traditional old age that my grandfather was able to maintain was possible only because my father's siblings had not left home as he had. We think nostalgically that we want the kind of old age my grandfather had, but the reason we do not have it is that in the end, we do not actually want it. The historical pattern is clear. As soon as people got the resources and opportunity to abandon that way of life, they were gone. The fascinating thing is that over time, it doesn't seem that the elderly have been especially sorry to see the children go. Historians find that the elderly of the industrial era did not suffer economically and were not unhappy to be left on their own. Instead, with growing economies, a shift in the pattern of property ownership occurred. As children departed home for opportunities elsewhere, parents who lived long lives found they could rent or even sell their land instead of handing it down. Rising incomes and then pension systems enabled more and more people to accumulate savings and property, allowing them to maintain economic control of their lives in old age and freezing them from the need to work until death or total disability. The radical concept of retirement started to take shape. Life expectancy, which was under 50 in 1900, climbed to more than 60 by the 1930s as improvements in nutrition, sanitation, and medical care took hold. Family sizes fell from an average of 7 children in the mid-1800s to just over 3 after 1900. The average age at which a mother had her last child fell too, from menopause to 30 or younger. As a result, vastly more people lived to see their children reach adulthood. In the early 20th century, a woman would have been 50 when her last child turned 21, instead of in her 60s a century before. Parents had many years, easily a decade or more, before they or their children had to worry about old age. So what they did was move on, just like their children. Given the opportunity, both parents and children saw separation as a form of freedom. Whenever the elderly have had the financial means, they have chosen what social scientists have called intimacy at a distance. Whereas in early 20th century America, 60% of those over age 65 resided with a child, by the 1960s, the proportion had dropped to 25%. By 1975, it was below 15%. The pattern is a worldwide one. Just 10% of Europeans over age 30 live with their children, and almost half live completely alone, without a spouse. In Asia, where the idea of an elderly parent being left to live alone has traditionally been regarded as shameful, the way my father saw it, the same radical shift is taking place. In China, Japan, and Korea, national statistics show the percentage of elderly living alone rising rapidly. This is actually a sign of enormous progress. Choices for the elderly have proliferated. Del Webb, an Arizona real estate developer, popularized the term retirement community in 1960 when he launched Sun City, a community in Phoenix that was among the first to limit its residents to retirees. It was a controversial idea at the time. Most developers believed the elderly wanted more contact with other generations. Webb disagreed. He believed people in the last phase of their lives didn't want to live the way my grandfather did, with the family underfoot. He built Sun City as a place with an alternate vision of how people would spend what he called their leisure years. It had a golf course, a shopping arcade, and a recreation center, and it offered the prospect of an active retirement of recreation and dining out with others like them to share it with. Webb's vision proved massively popular, and in Europe, the Americas, and even Asia, retirement communities had become a normal presence. For those who had no interest in moving into such places, Alice Hobson, for instance, it became acceptable and feasible to remain in their own homes, living as they wanted to live, autonomously. That fact remains something to celebrate. There is arguably no better time in history to be old. The lines of power between the generations have been renegotiated, and not in the way it is sometimes believed. The aged did not lose status and control so much as share it. Modernization did not demote the elderly. It demoted the family. It gave people, the young and the old, a way of life with more liberty and control, including the liberty to be less beholden to other generations. The veneration of elders may be gone, but not because it has been replaced by veneration of youth. It's been replaced by veneration of the independent self. There remains one problem with this way of living. Our reverence for independence takes no account of the reality of what happens in life. Sooner or later, independence will become impossible. Serious illness or infirmity will strike. It is as inevitable as sunset. And then a new question arises. If independence is what we live for, what do we do when it can no longer be sustained? In 1992, Alice turned 84. She was in striking health. She'd had to make a transition to false teeth and undergo removal of cataracts in both eyes. That was all. She'd had no major illnesses or hospitalizations. She still went to the gym with her friend Polly and did her own shopping and took care of her house. Jim and Nan offered her the option of turning their basement into an apartment for her. She might find it easier to be there, they said. She wouldn't hear of it. She had no intention of not living on her own. But things began to change. On a mountain vacation with the family, Alice didn't turn up for lunch. She was found sitting in the wrong cabin, wondering where everyone was. We'd never seen her confused like that before. The family kept a close eye on her for the next few days, but nothing else untoward happened. We all let the matter drop. Then Nan, visiting Alice at home one afternoon, noticed black and blue bruises up and down her leg. Had she fallen? No, Alice said at first, but later she admitted that she'd taken a spill going down the wooden basement stairs. It was just a slip, she insisted. It could have happened to anyone. She'd be more careful next time. Soon, however, she had more falls, several of them. No broken bones, but the family was getting worried. So Jim did what all families naturally do nowadays. He had her see a doctor. The doctor did some tests. He found that she had thinning bones and recommended calcium. He fiddled with her medications and gave her some new prescriptions. But the truth was he didn't know what to do. We were not bringing him a fixable problem. Alice was unsteady. Her memory was slipping. The problems were only going to increase. Her independence would not be sustainable for long now. But he had no answers or direction or guidance. He could not even describe what to expect would happen. And we'll stop there. That's the end of chapter one. And next week we start chapter two, Things Fall Apart. That is this week's edition of the Holistic Half Hour. Thanks for listening. This is Mary Jo Schottelcutty for Radio Reading Services on WRRS. Have a happy and healthy week.